You're listening to Stand Out with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Stand Out with myself, Ian O'Connell, is former journalist with the Irish Examiner, Donal Hickey. Donal began his journalistic career back in 1971 with the Kerryman newspaper. Donal was recruited as a junior reporter at a time when the newspaper employed over 120 people, 10 of whom worked in the newsroom. Donal covered some of the country's most memorable stories, like the Kerry baby story from start to finish. He's been through a lot in his career, so sit back and enjoy the show. Donal, thanks so much for coming in to me today. I'm delighted to have you in studio for a chat. How are you?
Very good, Ian, and yourself?
All good. Yeah. All over the Christmas.
Yeah. Just about. It's all over now, really. We're back to normal very much. Back to normal, yeah.
It comes and goes so quick, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Sure, it's only the week of Christmas, really. And after that, once people start going back to work again, sure, it's over, really, then.
It is, absolutely. You know. I suppose I like to ask my guests at the start, growing up, I suppose, you're Guinea Gwil originally. Were you... what were you like growing up? Do you like sports?
Oh, I did, of course. I spent a lot of my youth kicking a football around the place, like most other young fellas at the time. And there really wasn't much else to do there, really, to be honest, because it was the only recreation we had. It was the era. I grew up in the 50s and 60s, so it was pre-television, if you like. And it was an era when kids really entertained themselves very much. And they had to say, no, these on-screen games and anything like that, they were way into the future. And we spent our days, especially in the summertime, from almost dawn to dusk, out playing in the fields and in working in the bog maybe in some days and working in the meadows other days. But there was always time for play. And it was invariably football. And we just loved it, and we played in the street. The club in Guinea Gwil wasn't actually founded until around 1960 or 61.
So we
didn't have a field until then to call a football, that you might call a football field. Yeah. We played in the farm fields around the place and on the road a lot then, because the traffic was very light then, you know, very few cars were passing. But that was about it. And it was a kind of an idyllic youth in many ways, because, as I said, there was great company. There were a lot of young families growing up around the same time, and we had a lot of friends and schoolmates, and we'd mixed. It was all very local, really, very local.
Yeah. I suppose now you've the social media and the phones.
None of that, of course, that time.
Do you know what? A lot of people say social media is a bad thing. It can be a good thing then as well.
Yes.
But you know, when you're looking back now, I suppose you kind of say, I enjoyed it, that it wasn't around back then, was it? The phones and social
absolutely.
Media.
Absolutely. Well, I think what you had that time was great freedom.
Yeah.
And I think our parents just left us off in the summertime, go out and play. And, my mother would say, go away out and play. You're only coming my way around the house, that kind of thing. And there was a great sense of trust in the community. And people felt very, very safe. And I think it's probably a bit different nowadays. The parents are far more protective.
Yeah.
For good reasons, I'm sure, but that time you were just left off, and you had plenty of friends and company, and you know, it was in a way, it was a kind of an innocent age, I suppose.
Yeah,
really.
And I suppose back then the same and stuff, would football have been back? Would football have been a big thing in schools as well?
It was, yeah. We had a school team. And I remember playing in that, and within the parish. It was a parish. You had, I suppose, half a dozen or so national schools in the parish, and they played each other. I remember my last year in the school, we were beaten by Shrone, I think, and the final was played in the field in Ramore. The lawn, it was known as, the football field in Ratmore forever. It seemed to be there for years and years, but that was a great competition. And I remember there was a priest in the parish at the time, Father Dillon. He was a curate, and he was very much into schools football, and he had a Volkswagen Beetle, and he'd packed the whole Guinea Gwil team into the Beetle,
you know.
And he'd take us to matches and things like that. So he was a great man for sport and everything, and he was a very nice man, and he looked after us well, and we had great fun, really. Can't imagine now a football team. It was 9-a-side at the time. Packed into a Volkswagen, nine-a-side. Yeah.
Really?
You had a full back line of three, you had a goalkeeper, three in the full back line, two at midfield, and three in the full forward line. That's the way it lined out.
And was it like that for a long?
Well, through all my time anyway.
Yeah.
And So it seemed to work all right. You know, the two fellas in the middle did all the donkey work as usual. But yeah. I mean, I remember I played in the middle of the field with the late Jack McCarthy, who was a great friend of mine. And he only died there a few years ago. We were really lifelong friends forever because we were in school together and everything else. And we had great friendship and fun, really. It was great, great fun as well. And while it was very competitive, I think it was very sporting too, and you know, there was no bitterness or anything like that. You just, if you lost, you lost, and if you won, it was great. You know.
Did you enjoy the academic side of things?
Well, I wasn't great, really. I wasn't a great student. My late teacher, John O'Mahony, would probably he'd be honest enough to tell you. But I had a problem at school always that if I wasn't interested in a subject, I just couldn't bother with it much.
I was like,
that was my problem. For instance, I didn't like maths. And when I went to secondary school, then I didn't really like science either. But I liked languages, which was good for me. And I did pretty well in languages because I was interested and I had a natural kind of, I won't say talent for it, but a natural kind of ability for it. But other subjects then, I couldn't interest myself in them enough to do a bit of study even. Yeah. And I only barely passed them in exams then as a result, you know. But that was the way it was. I was just, I was a kind of an a la carte student, if you like. I picked what I liked.
And it makes it all easier when you enjoy something, you know, a subject, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it makes it very easy then when you've some bit of ability and you have an interest as well. Things like, I loved Irish and English now, for instance. And when I went to secondary school then in St. Brendan's, we did Latin and Greek. Would you believe Greek?
Oh,
now
yeah,
it
really?
Sounds crazy now, but Latin and Greek that time were part of the curriculum at second level. And of course, there was a reason for that. In that St. Brendan's was a diocesan college. It was run by the church and the diocese. Yeah. And part of the role of St. Brendan was that to provide students for the priesthood, and namely Maynooth, principally Maynooth. And the old scriptures and were written in languages like Greek and Latin and that. So you had to have a certain competence in Latin and Greek. That was the thinking of the time. And I don't know much. That's back in the 60s now. But that was the general idea. That
St. Brendan's have been a football school all since then, really, haven't they?
Oh, it was going way back. There's a huge football tradition there. It's synonymous with football in Kerry, of course. And at the moment, there's a group of us now researching the history of the college. And it dates to 1860.
Go away, really?
1860, yeah. And certainly going way back to the first quarter of the 20th century, there was a lot of football being played. And prior to that, they played games like cricket, would you believe?
Really?
Yes, because before the GAA was founded in 1884, cricket was a very popular game nationally, all over the country, yeah. But the GAA then, of course, encouraged hurling and football, and they took over. Yeah. And football has been part of life in the college for well over 100 years. Yeah, well over 100 years.
And we've seen some savage players come out of there, like,
absolutely,
know,
yeah.
Even lately, Clifford and all them.
Yeah, in my time now, you had some wonderful footballers in there. I remember Kevin Kennelly from Ballylongford. I remember John O'Keefe, Brendan Lynch, Paddy Lynch, Anthony O'Keefe, Joe O'Keefe from Tralee, John Long from Ventrake. I could go on naming people. I don't want to let anyone out either, but they were just some of the people that immediately come to mind. Yeah. They were outstanding footballers and proved it later in the Kerry jersey, you know.
Just goes to show.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was a place that encouraged, as I said, the total emphasis almost was on football. There was no other, handball was a popular game, but not at a competitive level.
Yeah.
No soccer, you had no rugby, and you had a bit of hurling because you had lads there from North Kerry, from the hurling parishes of North Kerry, and you had a bit of hurling, but it was 95% football, and that was the total emphasis, yeah.
And now that you mentioned the handball, actually, don't lie, when I was below, before my accident, we were trying to get hurling kind of more into the same, because I played a bit of hurling as well.
Yes.
And we used to go into the handball alleys at lunchtime.
Yeah.
And with the hurling and sitter off the wall. So it's funny you mention it there.
Yeah.
And it's still there to this day. Like,
oh, yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah. I remember as a boarder, we'd have our breakfast, obviously, and straight after breakfast, there'd be a rush out of the refectory and to be first into the handball alley to have a game in the morning before class.
Yeah.
And whoever was first in, they had the alley, obviously, until they had their game played. Someone else came in then. But the alleys were always busy. There was always action in the alleys. Yeah. There were four handball alleys there. And they were very busy places with handball. But they said any competitions we had there were internal competitions. I don't remember any St. Brendan's versus, the Green and Tralee or anything like that, like you had in football. But it was a very popular game at the same time, handball.
It's very important to shape somebody's life, I think, as a young person sport. Like it goes for making friends, growing as a person. I think sport is a massive role to play.
Yeah.
You mentioned there English and Irish Youlite, I suppose, moving on to the journalism side. What drew you to that?
Well, I think for a while I was a bit unsure of what I wanted to do with myself, to be very honest with you. And there was no career guidance that time in most schools, I'd say. There certainly wasn't in St. Brendan's. And it wasn't part of the normal daily life of the school. So you had no teacher with a specific role of career guidance. So you had to really make up your own mind about what you wanted to do. And I was very uncertain of what I wanted to do, to be honest about it. And eventually, I was thinking about journalism, all right, and there were very few formal courses in those days. I talk about the late 60s now, before journalism became a third level course. You had some courses, but they weren't really acknowledged as a third level qualification or anything like that. So I was thinking about it for a while, and I saw one day an ad in the Kerryman for a junior reporter. And I applied for it anyway, and I got it. The editor, I think, who at the time was Con Casey, or Seamus McConville, who was the news editor, contacted me and said, they offered me a job. But firstly, I had to become proficient in two things, shorthand and typing. So I had to learn how to type, and I had to learn shorthand, which is, in those days, was part of the journalist note-taking skill. You had to have shorthand that time. So I went off and I did a course in shorthand and typing, and I got a number of books to read and about journalism and about the basic techniques of journalism and writing and all that. And within, I suppose, that took about 6 to 12 months, maybe probably less than 12 months. But anyway, I did my courses in shorthand and typing, got my certs, and presented myself at the Rock Street office in Tralee in those days, the bottom of Rock Street, the main office of the Kerryman. And I started work there as a trainee. And in those days, you had no really formal courses that we were aware of, but you learned on the job.
Yeah.
And you learned from the senior people in the office. And you went out on jobs with them, you went to council meetings with them and out in stories and things like that. And you just watched them, and they told you things, and they were your mentors.
Yeah.
And that's how you learned the trade that time.
You were kind of in at the deep end straight away.
Yeah. Well, you were in at the deep end, yeah. But that was good, I think, because you had to concentrate on what you were doing, and you had to learn about things, and, you had to educate yourself, and self-educate to a great extent, say, about local authorities, because that time, newspapers covered a lot of council meetings and things like that. So you had to know the workings of local authorities. You could find yourself in a courtroom a day covering cases, so you had to know a bit about the law and what you could and what you couldn't do. So you had to educate yourself to a great extent, as well as being told by the senior people. And that was the way it was done at the time. And nowadays, it looks like a very primitive, the whole thing, the way the media has developed and the internet and social media. That time, the Kerryman was the sole media organ in County Kerry.
Really?
No other newspaper, obviously no radio station.
Yeah.
Radio Kerry was far into the future.
Yeah.
Rail and the Gaeltacht hadn't yet started, and it had complete monopoly of County Kerry, really. So it was the only news outlet for the county. It came out just the same as today, once a week. And we covered everything. Football, the local notes, very important. for local news for people. And in those days, one thing, there was an export element to it, in that a lot of people sent the Kerryman abroad to their relatives in England or America or wherever. And I think at that time, from memory, a couple of thousand papers used to be sent away, every week. It was news from home, basically, for our exiles. That day, of course, is long since gone with social media and everything else. But that time, I remember going into Eason's in Dublin when I was doing my courses and that, before I went into the Kerryman, and seeing the stacks of weekly newspapers from around the country, say on a Saturday morning, if you went into Eason's, stacks of the Telegraph, the Western People, the Tipperary Star. You had a thriving provincial newspaper industry at that time. Some counties had three papers.
Go away.
Yeah. I mentioned Tipperary. You had the Tipperary Star, you had the Nina Gargan, and you had the Clonmel Nationalist. So you had three, in some counties, you had three papers, you know, which it was really RTE that, I think, a very limited news compared to today. Yeah. And all these chat shows weren't really there at all at the time. So people depended very much on their local paper for their local news. And some of the local papers covered national news as well as local news, you know. So it was, they get very good coverage at the time, when the whole news industry, the whole communications industry was really, hadn't yet developed.
Yeah.
You know, it was very, very basic. So that was it. I mean, most journalists at that time, they learned their trade in the local papers.
Yeah.
Some went on to work in the Dublin papers. They went to work in RTE. I ended up in the, what was the Cork Examiner? Now the Irish Examiner. And people,
would you have been like the Kerry correspondent?
Yes, I was effectively that, yeah. I had spent 4 or 5 years in the Kerryman, including a number of years down in Mallow, in covering for the Corkman newspaper, which is the sister paper of the Kerryman. I was sent down there, I spent 3 years in Mallow, and then I got a job in the Examiner. And they were interested in appointing someone down this side of the country, in the southwest. So I was offered a position in Killarney. And of course, I was really delighted to get back to Killarney.
More local.
Yeah, because I love Killarney and I love Kerry, you know. So it suited me grand. And it was a huge area. And from the Shannon Estuary down to Bantry Bay, that was my area, really. And you had a huge coastline. You had two or three peninsulas and a very busy county, Kerry. It would be regarded as one of the best news counties, because things are always happening in Kerry.
Always.
Look at Jesse Buckley, for instance, in the news of the moment. People like, there are things always happening in Kerry.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you, I spent 40 years in the job, and I was busy every day. And you know, so it was something all the time. You'll always have things happening in a coastal community, coastal area as well, you know. And you had the fishing industry, you had, I remember we had some major drug seizures here in my time. I remember going down to Castletown Bear to cover those, and sometimes along the Kerry coast. And you had things happening all the time in Kerry. So it was a very busy beat, I can tell you that much, but enjoyable at the same time. And that time I was very young, you know, in the sense I started off with here in Kerry. I was pretty experienced. I had about 5 years experience behind me. And I was about 25 years of age, so I was full of enthusiasm and energy, which comes with that at that age of your life.
You were still young, but you had a lot of experience.
I had a lot of experience, and I knew the county pretty well, which was a major help. But it takes a while, you see, to build up contacts, you know.
Especially
if you're doing news, like I was doing mainly news, I did other things as well, but news was my main thing. But you had to have contacts all over the place, you know, people that you could contact or who would contact you. And it took a few years to build up a network of people that have contacts, as I say. You had to have a good contacts book, especially when you were responsible for an area to cover.
Yeah.
Because,
they're depending on you.
The editor said to me, he says, Noel, you're appointed there, you're the editor for that area.
Go away.
That's what he said to me. He said, look, you cover what happens, all the things of importance there. That's your job. And he says, you're effectively the editor for that region. It's fine. So I felt a lot of responsibility, but eventually you get come to terms with it when you know, it's like any job when you get a bit of experience and you know who's who really in the county, you know, and the main thing is to figure out what's news, what's of interest to most people.
Of the people.
Yeah, and what's important, really, in the life of the place.
And like you said, there is always something happening in Kerry, even Jesse Buckley. Now, there's any stories, I suppose, there's big ones, Kerry Babies, anyone stand out to you?
Well, the Kerry Babies is one, obviously.
You covered that
from the start. Oh, I did, from the very start to the finish. I spent about 6 months covering it. Well,
that was huge at the time, like.
It was huge. I think I was the first journalist to actually to break the story at the time, yeah. And I got a good tip off, I got a phone call from a contact down around Garsavine to say that there's been a discovery on the beach, and that's how it started, really. Yeah. The baby's body was found. And I stayed with it, and the paper told me stick with it right through. The tribunal lasted from January until June of 85. The actual story started in April of 84, but the tribunal was what attracted all the attention. That was actually the investigation into the whole thing. And that really went on. It finished up in Dublin Castle in the month of June. I remember we started in the snows and the frost of January, going over there in the morning, bad mornings, and then the sun was splitting the stones when it finished. So it went on that long. It was a marathon. It was only supposed to last about 2 to 3 weeks.
Go away.
And sure, it nearly went on for 6 months, you know. It was huge media coverage. All the Dublin papers were there. RTE were there.
It marked a turning point in Irish, like, you know.
I suppose it did in many ways.
Yeah.
Some people used to say that it kind of exposed the hidden Ireland, you know.
Yeah.
Even though, and I think it opened things up a lot. It opened things up a lot. And I think it also energized the women's movement at the time, which was just about starting, you know. I think probably 70s, 80s year, the women were starting to mobilize and organize, and it fed into that very much, I think. And sure, they're still making television documentaries about
still
40 years after.
It's still a huge story. Was there any other ones that
I've forgotten about a lot of them, I'll tell you the truth. I remember one, as I mentioned to you earlier, Ian, about the sea, you know, that there's always things happening in the sea, you know,
the coastal areas.
But one night I was sitting at home, it was a very stormy night, and the phone rang about 10 o'clock, you know. It was obviously the manual phone of no mobiles that time.
Yeah.
It was the early 80s, about 81, I'd say, and a person from West Kerry rang me and said, there's a major rescue operation going on back here in Cumie and Old Beach. So there's a trawler, it was a Spanish container ship called the Ranga, which went on the rocks at Cumie and Old. It was a desperate stormy night. They said there's all kinds of drama going on. The boat is on the rocks and they're trying to rescue the sailors and the people on board. And so I went back and with a photographer. The first person I saw standing on the top of the cliff was Paddy O'Shea, the great Kerry footballer. Yeah. With a pair of green and gold socks outside his pants.
Are you serious?
And he was shouting and roaring, giving orders to about maybe half a dozen other men. What they were doing was they had ropes reaching down to the ship. They were standing at the top of the cliff. The boat was below on the rocks. And they were actually pulling the sailors up with the ropes.
Up with the ropes.
Yeah. They did that. I saw them bringing a few to safety. But earlier they had called for marine rescue assistance. That time we didn't have our own helicopters in Ireland.
Really?
No. So an RAF helicopter was sent for, it was based in Brodie in Wales.
Go away.
And I'll never forget the sight of the helicopter coming in the distance with lights flashing. It was like a spacecraft coming in, and you could hear the drama and the space. It was a dark night, you know, really stormy, terrible black night. And to see the helicopter battling the wind, it doesn't seem to be and it came to a halt right over the old ship, you know, that was in trouble. Still, just absolutely still.
Yeah.
And they lowered down a winchman from the helicopter, and one by one he hauled up what sailors were left on the boat. It was a night of really high drama, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Especially like when it came from Wales.
That's right, it had to come from Wales on a terrible night, you know. But now we've our own helicopters, you see, which is great, really. But that was, and I also had a lot to do with rescues in Carntuil. The Kerry Mountain Rescue Team, which to this day is very busy.
Yeah.
It's probably busier now because there are more people going on to the mountains. But in those days, pre-mobile phone again, you had a kind of a walkie-talkie system which was not quite as efficient as the mobile phones. And there was a base camp that time at Cronin's, what we now know as Cronin's Yard in the Sly Band. And Joe and Eileen Cronin were the people whose house was used as a base camp. I always call it the base camp by the guards and the rescue people and the media.
They used their houses?
They did, as a base. And she was a great woman, Eileen. God rest her now, and Joe too, but for making tea for people and that. She entertained, or she fed mountain rescue people and different people. She was a lovely woman to go into, and her house, she was lovely open fire. It was an old-fashioned kind of setup there. It was great, very homely person. And we had some great times up there waiting for the rescue team to come back down to report someone usually injured. Unfortunately, a few times, people had died.
Really?
Just people's bodies had died in falls. But that time, there was a lot of drama attached to mountain rescues in those days. And you often go up there in appalling conditions, in desperate wet nights and nights in the snow and the frost. And very dangerous for the mountain rescue people themselves, even though they were very experienced mountaineers. But they provided a fantastic service, and they still do.
Still do to this day. You said there, like, sometimes journalists, people may overlook it that they unfortunately have to cover hard stories.
Yes.
Like you say, maybe up the mountain or maybe a crash or something.
Yeah.
Do you think that sometimes stories like that covering it could have taken a toll on the person covering the story?
I think they do, because we're all human, you know, and you have to cover the tragedies too, and you know, it's part of your news. People want to know about it as well. It's often of public interest, and it does because I think I found it harder as I got older, strangely enough, because from your own life experiences, and you know, we all have our bereavements in life and tragedies in our lives, and that you think you probably feel more for people when you've experienced things yourself.
Yeah.
And it certainly was never easy, but it got harder, I found, as I got. I just hate the thought of having to cover very sad occasions, you know. And but you had to do it, you know, and there were awful tragedies over the years, terrible car crashes, things like that, you know, and it's never easy. It's never easy, like, you know, but you just have to do it if you're in the job, and you do it as sensitively as you can.
Comes with the job.
Yeah, and I think you try to take the feelings of the families concerned very much at heart. You try to be aware of all that, like, but it has to be done in a sensitive way, you know. Yeah.
I suppose covering politics and elections.
Yes. Oh, God, I just love elections. Yeah.
Covering, I suppose, the Healy Rays and stuff. What was that like, covering elections?
Well, very colourful. I know Jackie very well.
Really?
Founding father of the Healy Ray dynasty, really. Yeah. And it is a dynasty, you know.
Absolutely.
Jackie was probably, he was definitely the most colourful politician I ever knew. He had an unbelievable charisma, I suppose. Great canvasser. He'd pull votes out of the most unpromising places. He was a great raconteur, could tell stories, could very funny at times, could play music. I first met him in the Kerry County Council, I think around 1973. But as I mentioned earlier, I was working down in Mallow for a few years for the Corkman. There was a great by-election in the end of 1974 in Cork. What was the Cork North East constituency, and Mallow was kind of a hub of it.
Yeah.
But one night, it was one of the final nights of the election campaign, there was a big Fianna Fáil rally in the town. Jackie was a Fianna Fáil councillor at the time. And I was on the street with another reporter and a friend of mine, Ray Ryan, who worked for the Examiner, and we were just waiting. The crowds were gathering, you know, a lot of people, thousands of people would attend final rallies in those days. And next thing, a Mercedes pulled up at the western end of the town, I think. And this man hopped out. He wore an Astrakhan cap, very unique kind of a cap. Jackie wore that cap always in his earlier days, and another man with him. But they hopped out, and next thing, he opened the boot of the car and started firing out sods of turf. And we said, God almighty, what's going on here? You know? And next thing, I saw men lining up, and one fella came up with what looked like a can of diesel or paraffin or some oil, and they soaked the sods into the paraffin or the petrol, and the men, they had about 30 or 40 men, were lining up with pikes, two-pronged pikes, and the men stuck, each man stuck his pike into the sod, and the sod was lit and a flame. So what lined up was two lines of people with blazing pikes and sods of turf. And that parade went down the street. And Jackie organised that parade. And I spoke to him after, and I learned that it wasn't his first time. He says that was a big part of election rally. It's a very colourful event. The final rally, speeches from the candidates. He said he had done a number of those and by-elections around the country. The final rally, the parade. It was on a dark winter's night, a very colourful scene. Two lines of men marching up the street with pikes and the sods on top of each pike, and they're blazing, you know. And that was the way. So that was a memorable encounter with Jackie. And that night, I've never forgotten that night. Never forgotten that night. For the first time I saw it, and I thought it's really very memorable. But he was, funny enough, he wasn't that big a vote getter compared to the sons now. And his grandchildren are very big vote getters. But remember, he didn't have the same machine either that the Healy race have now. He was basically a one-man show in many respects. Now
they're huge now.
Because remember, you have two TDs and three county councillors. That's massive.
Yeah.
In one part of the country, just in one county.
Yeah.
So it's a very tight organisation, family controlled, and I mean, their vote getting ability is unreal.
Yeah.
And
always.
Always. Yeah. So when they work as a team, it's very hard to compete with them. They work as a team. It's an incredible story. I wrote a book about it there about 10 years ago.
You did? I was going to say that. Yeah. What was that?
I wrote Jackie's biography back in the late 90s. That was it. But the last book I did about him was, it was probably a more comprehensive story because the two sons, Michael and Danny, had emerged.
Yeah.
Jackie had died, of course. Jackie was dead at that stage, but it had moved into the third generation, if you like. So it was probably I try to do an assessment of their life and times and how they achieved what they achieved and all that. It was more of an in-depth look because the first book was about Jackie himself. It was a biography.
Yeah.
And there was only Jackie at that time because none of the family were involved at that stage. So it was a good story in itself. He had a very colourful upbringing as well, you know, and came out of very poor circumstances, self-made man in every respect. Spent a bit of time in New York, never liked America, came home in the mid-50s. He bought a tractor, started working for farmers, mowing hay and things like that, and that's how his business developed.
Michael's mother was from America, wasn't
it? Pardon?
Michael's mom.
Very much so. Julie, yes. She was American-born.
Yeah.
But her roots were in Kilgarvan.
Yeah.
And Jackie, as I said, he was a hurler as well, of course. He played county championship with Kilgarvan when they were a hurling force back in the 50s. So he opened the pub then around in the late 60s in Kilgarvan. Still there, still going well. Still, and he tried many different things and invariably succeeded. And politics came after his success in business in many respects, because he had built up his farm contracting business, his civil engineering business, and he's a great life story, really. And he lived to be in his 80s, you know. And but as I said, he was very, very colourful, and
he was very well respected at that time.
Oh, he was, yes. He was a very popular person. Yeah. And, you know, he was one of these people that if you met him once, you'd never forget him.
Forget him, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, it just goes to show what he started and what they are now today. They're a machine, like, together.
Well, they're a very professional machine now. Yeah. They're highly organised. You know, what can you say about them? The votes prove it. Like, yeah. They're a phenomenon, you know. And it all comes out of the ballot box.
Yeah.
I mean, what amazes me about them is their availability.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really 24/7 stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think any of them ever switch off their mobile phones.
No. See, there was a Denny in the Doll one day. It was on TV and the phone started going and he said, I won't turn off my phone.
No. This total availability.
Yeah.
And I remember Michael at one stage used to conduct clinics in some pubs in Kinmare on a Saturday night. Now, I'm not sure if he still does it because I'm kind of retired now for a few years, so I wouldn't be in touch that much.
But in Scott's Hotel as well, isn't he?
He used.
I think so.
And the fault.
Yeah.
But the reason most people socialise on a Saturday night, they go out for a meal or a drink or meet people. But not Michael Ealy. He saw that as an opportunity to meet his constituents, to meet people that he knew they were going to be out, but he had his notebook in his pocket, as Jackie used to have. And Jackie never went anywhere without the notebook in the pocket. I remember Jackie used to come to Killarney every Saturday night. You mentioned Scots. He used to be there in the fault in different places.
He knew people
but
of your own.
Jackie would have a drink. He wasn't a drinking person at all. He might have one or two max, but people would come up to him and he would talk to them maybe quietly or privately in a corner. And you'd see the notebook out and he taking his notes. So that he'd take down whatever the client wanted or whatever problem they had, he'd take his notes. And that was the way that he operated. This people availability, you see, this availability to the public. I mean, the funeral attendances is...
That says...
That alone, the time that takes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they just are available to people all the time. And I don't know how they can do it. The energy it takes, the time it takes. They do it.
They do, travelling up and down to Dublin. One more minute before we finish up. I suppose away from politics and stuff, covering sport. Did you enjoy that side?
Oh, I did indeed,
Success Kerry.
I was very lucky in the sense that I came on the scene in 75 as a sports journalist, if you like, which is part of my brief.
Yeah.
And it was the first of the Kerry's great triumphs, really, the golden era, as they call it now, started in 75. They beat Dublin in that All-Ireland final, which I was involved in the coverage of as well. And I started then, and I kept going in sport, I'd say, for more than 20 years, really.
Really?
Yeah. Down to Paddy O'Shea's era. And I got to know, I had a very good relationship with the late Mick O'Dwyer.
Really?
And in particular... And he was very good. He was a lot of raw green in him, of course, but Cork and Kerry at that time had a great rivalry, very close. Cork, it was touch and go in a lot of games, I think. Back in the 70s, Cork had a great team. The likes of Ray Cummins, Jimmy Barry, Murphy, Dini Allen, all those players that were outstanding. Kevin Ger Sullivan, brilliant players, you know. And they were as good as Kerry. The problem was with Cork that they couldn't score as well as Kerry.
Yeah.
And they often had the edge on Kerry and they should have won games that they lost because they didn't have the same scoring ability.
Yeah.
Kerry always had forwards, you know. But anyway, it was great to get to know players. Like, I remember that time journalists had a lot more access to players. I remember the week before the 75 All-Ireland final, McInnes O'Sullivan was teaching in Ballyvourne. And I rang him up one day and I said, Mick, I'd like to talk to you. He was a Kerry captain, of course. I'd like to talk to him maybe to do an interview before the All-Ireland. Now you won't get near him at all before the match. But he says, of course, he says, come away down to the... He spoke to the school principal, a fellow called Micheál O'Leonard, who was a very nice man too. But I said, I'd like to talk to you to get pictures of yourself in the classroom with the students. And he said, I'll call you back. I'd say within 5 or 10 minutes, he rang me back. The principal gave the go-ahead. Come down, he said, we arranged him a day. So I went down and I spoke to him. This is only a week before the All-Ireland, in total access, classroom, students, pictures, all that. Nowadays, you wouldn't get that kind of access. No. But that time, the players were very... I remember part of my duties used to be... On All-Ireland final day, I'd have two jobs. One was to write the front page, what was known as a colour piece in the Examiner. A descriptive piece describing the atmosphere, the crowd and the excitement and all that stuff. It was known as a colour piece, right? Shortish enough, but in the front page. That put you on the front page because it was a big day. And then interviews after the match, the post-match interviews with the players and the managers and things like that. But that time, you could walk straight into the dressing room and walk up to the players. Sometimes they were drying themselves down when you'd be interviewing them. And you wouldn't be the only reporter in there. There'd be several... And the players were totally accessible.
That's amazing.
Mick O'Dwyer was totally accessible. I found him. The man, he'd just talk to you at any time, any place. And at that time, that accessibility, which is gone now, the people who are covering sport now, telling me that it's very hard to get access to.
Yeah.
There's a code of silence as well. It's imposed coming up to matches in case they give away some of their tactics or something. Yeah. But that time, no.
And it's amazing.
It was amazing, yeah. But you develop great friendships with players as well. Yeah. That has lasted to this day, some of the Kerry team. I mentioned, Mickey and Ed. We've been very good friends ever since. And people like that, John O'Keefe, people like that. You could always talk to them at any time,
Yeah.
And once you were fair with them and didn't misquote them or anything, that was obviously taken for granted that you wouldn't do. You just quote exactly.
Give them your trust as well.
Trust. Yeah, it's all about trust. I thought they were a wonderful team, but the 70s, 80s Kerry footballers. Ambrose O'Donovan was a very good friend of mine as well. Oh, yes, yeah. But people like that, and it was great to be covering sport that time. I think there was still, I suppose, a sort of an innocence about sport that time, which it's gone a bit cynical now, and it's gone very commercial as well.
It is. Marketing and all that side of things.
Yeah, money has come into it in a big way.
Absolutely.
And that time it wasn't, No, it was...
Different time.
It was lovely, really. I enjoyed sport very well. I love football anyway, as I mentioned earlier. I spent my youth kicking your ball around Guinea, will I? But it was great to be involved in all that and all those finals from the 70s and the 80s. It was a wonderful time for Kerry.
Yeah.
And, of course, the big thing then, after the All-Ireland, you'd have to cover the homecoming. The Monday night, the team had come down. That time they travelled by train. And the homecoming was huge. I mean, I remember nights in Killarney, the guards estimated the crowds at around anything to 8,000 to 10,000 people,
Right.
And the speeches in those days used to be made up at the top of High Street, where the old Park Place Hotel, long since demolished, was located, where O'Shea's Tyres are now.
Oh, on the right,
across
yeah,
the
yeah.
street from that, you had the...
by the advertiser now, up that
Yes, that's exactly the location. There's a block of apartments there now.
Yeah.
But that was the old Park Place Hotel. And that's where the lorry would stop after the parade from the railway station right through the town. Crowds, thousands of people out in the streets. Speeches then from Micheál de Wire, the chairman of the county board and all that, and the crowd going mad, especially when Kerry had win, and we'll be back. And if when they'd lose, then they'd turn out as well in their thousands. But and of course, the Wire would say, we'll be back, and the crowd would rise to that again. So there were unbelievable nights in Killarney, the homecoming, I don't know, the crowds don't seem to be as big anymore. That time, absolutely huge.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll be in the Glebe car park in a couple of months.
Hopefully, well, it's the Glebe car park now,
really appreciate you coming in now. For
no bother, Ian.
And thanks a million.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Now, unfortunately, that's all we've time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I really appreciate you tuning in as always. If you have any suggestions, questions, or requests before next week's show, you can get in contact with me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or you can send me an email through my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. I hope you're all having a great week so far. Stay tuned in here to Radio Kerry, because Brian Priestley is up next with That's Jazz. I'll be back at the same time next week from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
You're listening to Standout with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.